In chapters 2 and 7, we were presented with four political world kingdoms. The first was identified as Babylonian. The second was the Medo-Persian. And the third kingdom was identified as the Grecian Empire. In this particular vision, we are going to look at the period between the fall of Babylon and the fourth beast, or fourth world empire. Specifically, chapter 8 deals with the second and third empires leading up to it. Okay? So, we talked about last week how chapters 1 and then 8 through 12 are all written in Hebrew, and chapters 2 through 7 are written in Aramaic, which is an interesting twist on this particular book. But first question we kind of talked about last week, phone's running over back there, in what year did the vision appear unto Daniel? What year was it? Get my right, Terry.
Well, it was the third year that Belshazzar reigned.
Right, right. We determined from this chart last week that it was approximately 557. That'd be the third year of Belshazzar's reign. And just in case anybody missed out, the where it says AM there, this is the date from creation according to Usher. And it's approximate and has a lot of gaps in it, but it gives you an idea of how this falls in the course of time since the creation of man. So his reign ended about 3685 AM, 539 BC. Okay? Now, let's see here. I guess we got to go to the next question. We talked about last week, and I think where we left off was somewhere about this. The chapters 7 and 8 are chronologically prior to the events in chapter 5. Okay, so don't get confused with that. Okay, in this vision, what? Who? Let's put it that way. Daniel saw a... which had... two horns, and one was higher than the other, and came up last. Now you'll notice, have a ram up here that's got one horn high and one horn low. This kind of gives you an idea of what we're talking about as far as this goes. In the text here, he saw the ram, and he saw in the vision it was by the river Eulay, and he lifted up his eyes and saw standing beside the river a ram which had two horns, and the one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. Now, you have to envision this now. He saw it, and that higher one came up in the last part of his vision, came up last. That means the other one was already there. So that was how the vision came to him. Okay? Then the ram symbolized the kings of Media and Persia. Okay? Then add Daniel 8 and verse 20. That's what tells us what it means. The ram's pictured as pushing, conquering to the west, north, south, and no animal or beast, world empire, could stand before him. Notice now, he says it was pushing to the north, south, and then to the west. And that's how we have this envisioned here. Now, what this means is it was pushing towards Babylonia, Syria, Asia Minor, Palestine, North Armenia, and the regions about the Caspian Sea, South Egypt, and Ethiopia. That all those regions are covered in this. Okay? Somebody very graciously has done a lot of work on charts, and so I'm using them. Okay. Any comments or questions now? Okay. The ram is pictured, okay, pushing. Okay. Here we go. Just number five. Then Daniel then saw a male goat that came from the west and had a notable horn between its eyes. Okay? Now, this was a goat. It wasn't like this ram. It was a goat and it had a...
Unigoat.
No.
That's what it is. It's a unigoat.
No. No, he hasn't got sparkles on him or anything. He's mean. Which comes back to question six. The rough male goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn is the first king. Now, the great horn doesn't represent a kingdom. This is, want to keep that in mind. And it doesn't represent kings in general either. It represents specifically Alexander the Great. After conquering the entire eastern Mediterranean world, including Egypt, Alexander invaded Persia in 331 BC and defeated Darius III. Interesting. Now, the phrase, touch not the ground, indicates the rapidity of his conquests and fits the picture of the third beast, who is described as being like a
leopard with four wings.
That is a neat picture. A leopard with wings. And this, of course, as the text tells us, is identifying the power and strength and the rapidity with which this particular kingdom was represented. Now, the he-goat, which was the Grecian Empire, came to the ram, which is the Medo-Persian Empire, and attacked, yeah.
Smote, yeah.
It attacked it or smote the ram. And what did it do? Breaking his horns so that there was no power in the ram. This is a picture of kind of what took place here. This fellow's a little bit neater looking than the fellow we saw a minute ago. But the idea is the representation. You see the horns down here laying on the ground and so forth. Okay, now, let's see. When the he-goat was very great and what happened when the he-goat was very great and strong? What happened when he grew great and strong? Had that large horn that he had on the center there was broken. And in its place, well, we're going to talk about the next question. What replaced the great horn? Four notable horns. And notice what it says. They came up toward the four winds of heaven. They're going all directions, okay? Now, the four notable horns are four kingdoms that shall stand up out of the nation, but not in it its power. Daryl? Okay, all right. The broken horn, was replaced by four other horns that came up. And upon the early death of Alexander, and he's the great horn, remember? The death of Alexander in 323 B.C., at the age of 33. And by the way, there's speculation as to why he died early. Some think it's because of a disease that he didn't seek any help for when he had it. And some think somebody might have poisoned him. But either way, he died early. Yes?
I also understand he had an arrow wound.
That may be.
Prior battle, a week and a half.
Yeah.
Prior.
Yeah. That may have been what he had, something that needed attending to that put him down. But anyway, he died at an early age, which is pretty interesting whenever you think a man lived to be 33 and he's Alexander the Great. He was already great. Pretty good. The great Grecian Empire was divided into four parts, four horns, each led by one of his generals. Macedonia under Cassander, Thrace and Asia Minor under Lysimachus, Syria under Seleucus, and Egypt under Ptolemy. Okay? Now, out of one of the four horns, that is, the four notable horns, came a little horn. Yeah, it's a little horn that waxed, which waxed exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the
Yeah,
the glorious land. In Josephus writes in his Antiquities, and by the way, this is something that will help us to deal with this glorious land. In Antiquities, the 10th chapter, 11th section, and verse 7, he says, "And there would arise from their number a certain king who would make war on the Jewish nation and their laws, deprive them of the form of government based on these laws, spoil the temple and prevent the sacrifice from being offered 3 years. And these misfortunes our nation did in fact come to experience under Antiochus Epiphanes, just as Daniel many years before saw and wrote that it would happen." This is the little horn. Okay? The pleasant or glorious land has reference to the land of Israel. And there's a whole bunch of verses here we could look at, but I won't take time to do that right now. Okay? Now, very interesting. See, going through Daniel this way, you don't get bogged down. You get the high points, you get the basis of it, but you don't get bogged down. I like that. Further, the little horn that grew out of the one of the four waxed great even to the what?
Host of heaven.
Yeah, the host of heaven. Some of these, it says it cast down and trampled. Now, how this was accomplished in the vision is difficult to understand, I think. At least in my mind. But if one contemplates the details of casting down stars and trampling upon them, then you kind of have a grotesque a vision of what went on, extremely grotesque. But the central thought, as depicted in the simple words of the text, is very forceful. I want you to listen carefully. I want to read to you from the Second Maccabee, which you don't have in your Bibles unless you're carrying a Catholic Bible. Second Maccabee, chapter 9 and verse 10, and it speaks of Antiochus. And listen to this. The man that a short while before thought of himself to touch the stars of heaven. That's how it's described. To touch the stars of heaven. The text of 2 Maccabees is a reflection of Daniel's language here, I believe that's the case. The host of heaven, stars, like in Jeremiah 33:2, talking about the stars up in the heaven. But the figure is used of the people of God or the saints. In Daniel 12:3 and also Matthew 14:43. The imagery of Revelation 12:4 is probably also based on this passage. So we have similarities in these passages. These saints are the true believers under the old dispensation and members of the holy nation. Remember, God always has had a people. And these were members of the holy nation, or true believers, under the old dispensation. Okay?
The
Yes, yes, right.
Daniel
12:3 and Matthew 14:43. I'm sorry. I can't see you tonight, Julie. Where are you? Oh, there you are. I see you now. I couldn't see you there, Julie. I heard your voice, but didn't see you. Yes.
Okay, remind me. I know the story about the Maccabees and the oil and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah.
But why would the Catholics have it? Is it just a secular writing?
Okay.
I forget.
Okay, we'll go aside here. The writings of the Maccabees mm-hmm. were a group of writings that took place in the period between Malachi and the coming of Christ. Okay? They were written, and remember, there was no prophet whatsoever during that time period, because God had had it with them. And they knew they didn't have a prophet, but it didn't keep them from writing. And what they were writing was history. They were recording their history as it went along, which meant it was not free from error, but it was an interesting history. But in the Maccabees, the part of it that is a problem is some of the writing of the Maccabees reflects superstitions and traditions of the Jews that were not God's will. And so there are things in the Maccabees that are interesting and like Josephus is interesting, but things that are interesting, but they're not inspired. And one thing that's very interesting to me about it, all the writings of the intertestamental period, none of the writings claim inspiration. They were smart enough to know that they better not claim to be inspired, because God wasn't talking to anybody then. So, but the Catholics, you want to know why they grabbed it? Because it has a concept in there that the Catholics turned into purgatory. And I've been told by a Catholic lately that they've given up on that doctrine, but I don't know what the deal is with it. Probably has a new papal bull or spoken from the chair. Terry said I'm speaking from the chair, so anyway. That's the reason why they cling to it, because of the traditions and so forth that they incorporated into Catholicism.
Thanks for refreshing.
Yeah, that's okay. All righty. Where were we? Oh, this king magnified himself even to the prince of the host and took away the daily sacrifices. Okay. And he cast down the truth. And he cast down the what? The sanctuary. That's right. Actually, looking into history, Syria, which is one of the four divisions into which Alexander the Great's empire fragmented, was governed by Seleucus Nicator, which was his whole name, head of the Seleucid dynasty, from which Antiochus the IV emerged in 175. He took the title, now listen to this, Theos Antiochus Epiphanes, which means Antiochus the illustrious God. Yes, he took the title of God. Excuse me, Antiochus Epiphanes.
Antiochus Epiphanes?
Yes, it's E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S. Epiphanes. In his expansionist policy, he overran Palestine, which is the beautiful land we just talked about, sacked Jerusalem, amid a terrible bloodshed. He abolished the daily morning and evening sacrificial offerings. Abolished it. And he committed blasphemy by sacrificing a pig on the altar of burnt offering. And later, adding insult to injury, he placed a statue of Zeus in the temple of God, and then made human sacrifices on the altar. He forbade them to practice circumcision. He profaned the Sabbath. What more could you do? And that comes from the 21st edition of the New Bible Commentary, that whole history section I just read. Yes, sir.
Do you know who it was supposed to be for, the human sacrifices?
No.
No? Because I was just thinking, if it were to be in the presence of that Zeus statue, just from that polytheistic view, I didn't believe that they did human sacrifices to Zeus.
Well, they were polytheistic. They didn't just worship Zeus.
Okay, I So that statue's in the presence of that God.
There were plenty of deities that they worshipped that required human sacrifice. Vicki?
Wasn't the
excuse me.
Head guy for them?
Yeah, he was the chief god. Yeah. Daryl?
I think the point about Zeus sacrifices in the temple of God was not to further their god's standing, but more to degrade the people around them.
Well, the whole thing, I mean, offering a pig on the, the whole thing was to, it was an in-your-face to the Jews, is what it was. It was an in-your-face to the Jews.
And he was a Greek guy? Who was he? Antiochus?
Well, yeah, he was a Greek. Yeah, he was a Greek.
He was a Greek king?
No, he wasn't a king. No. Antiochus Epiphanes was the, let's see, what would I just read here to you? He was part of the, he was, because whenever his father had died, he became the king in 175 BC. Yeah. Yeah, he was king. But I'll have some more to say about him just a little bit. I got some other information on him. You're going to love this. 15. The little horn is a king having fierce features and what? Understanding sinister schemes. Now, if that doesn't give you nightmares, I don't know what will. Vicki saw that on my screen. She says, "What's that?" But that's the little horn. Okay. Now, we don't often talk about understanding sinister schemes. What do sinister schemes mean?
Satan's way of life.
Okay. 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 Susan?
In American standards,
go ahead.
They use the word intrigue, and then in the footnote, it says ambiguous speech.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking circular logic to try to win people over, even though what you're saying doesn't make any sense.
Right. Let me give you the definitions, and it'll all fit what we're talking about. A master at understanding hidden things. Master of intrigue, one of the definitions. It has to do with riddles, hard questions, and allegories. Hidden things, intriguing things. Scorn, the asking, now listen, the asking of a riddle as a game could imply scorn and ridicule towards the person asked. Why does somebody do that? To make fun of them. That's what they want. This is further definitions. Has to do with puzzles, hints, a trick, a conundrum, or sententious maximum. Dark sayings. We know what that means. Hard questions, proverbs, and riddles. Now, all the rest, I have some more down here, but they're all pretty much the same. There's one, though, that's a little bit different, and that is perplexing questions or difficult questions. A little bit different wording. But that's what this little horn was doing. That's what he was doing. And a host, many of the Israelites, because of their transgressions, were given over to the horn by God. Together with the daily sacrifice in the sanctuary, the horn cast down the truth to the ground. And notice what the text says. He prospered. That means he realized great success in what he did. Okay? Now, we're not told whether Antiochus made a formal claim to deity, that is, directly. But while he was enthroned in the court of the Jerusalem temple, he certainly did assume the right to determine what gods his subjects would worship. And he had the feeling that he was the earthly embodiment of the powers of heaven, and that all rule and authority were given to him. Now, who's that sound like? Does that ring a bell? Like Nebuchadnezzar? He expected all of his subjects to bow down to the great image he set up. But he went even beyond Nebuchadnezzar in trying to abolish the ancestral religion of the Jews and forbid them on the pain of death to circumcise their children and make the possession of the Hebrew Scriptures a capital offense. Now, think about that. That was a desperate situation the Jews lived in. By erecting the statue of Zeus or Capitolinus, that's another name for it, Capitolinus. Anyway, it's another name of this particular god. But to do this in the temple of the Lord and sacrificing swine on the altar, he committed the greatest possible sacrilege or affront to the Jewish people. Okay? He was a mess. Now, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully, and he shall prosper and thrive, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. That's exactly right. He would in this description take the throne through deceit. And it appears that it was taken from the rightful heir, who was actually Demetrius. Yes, Cheryl. Antiochus Epiphanes.
Okay, I guess you said
that. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. Yes.
This is not the right representation, though.
Oh, really?
Because this is the little horn that comes up in the fourth kingdom that takes off three of the ten, that replaces three of the ten.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking for just the little horn and the big noise.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, there you are. Okay.
Not a big deal, other than it was...
No problem. Yeah, I know. I know what you're talking about. I just wanted that fierceness of it. Now let's get back on track. Okay? The rightful heir was Demetrius. His great power would not be his own, but the source of it would be what? Satan. That's right. Exactly. He would succeed at first, defeating powerful rulers and generals and destroying many of God's people and deceiving himself, thinking himself to be great enough to oppose God. Nevertheless, he would ultimately and suddenly be shattered. Not through assassination or battle, but by some ailment sent by God. Very interesting. Okay, 17. This king shall... Yes?
When, of course, this makes me think how Christians were persecuted later.
Right, that's right.
But...
It's that's why it's parallel to the book of Revelation.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what... What struck me here is the forbidding of circumcision. That was how they became Israelite, right?
Yeah.
That's how they became a child of God.
Yeah.
And so by them acquiescing to that, that's he was trying to just destroy them by doing that.
That's it.
Just like Herod did with trying to...
He was taken away... the mark that identified them as God's people. And he refused to let them do it. Now, you just take a few, you know, generation or two, you know, doesn't take very long, and you've got a bunch of people who are away from God and don't know who they belong to. And they're just like the Jew, the Gentiles then. They become just Greeks. And that's very, very true. Very true. Okay. He shall exalt himself in his heart, shall destroy many, and shall stand up against the Prince of Princes. Who's that? Bonus question. Who's that? God. That's right. That he thought he was powerful enough that he could confront God and be victorious. But we found out that he wasn't. This proud king shall be... Oh, yeah, we know what this means. Proud king shall be broken without human means. Okay. The expression, without hands... means, and that's in Daniel 8 and verse 25, without hands, let's read it now, through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, he shall exalt himself in his heart, destroy many of their prosperity, and shall rise against the Prince of Princes, but he shall be broken without human means. And then verse 34, you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them to pieces. Daniel 2, verse 45, inasmuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. Now, down here, you only have A and B. So you got a 50-50 chance. Without human hand or by divine power?
Which is A?
We've had other ones like this. I just don't get it. Yes, it was without human hands. Okay? But yes, it was by divine power. All of the above. We'll put C down, all of the above. Okay, as long as you get the point, know what it means, okay? It was not man's doing. That's what we want to remember, okay? Okay, now, in your note here on 8:4, it says, "Who is this awesome king of fierce countenance with mighty power to destroy, even to destroy God's holy people, take away the sacrifice, pollute the temple, and stand up against God?" Who was it? Antiochus Epiphanes. Says, "This king comes forth as a little horn from out of the notable horns which arise out of the Grecian Empire after the death of Alexander." Okay? We've already covered this about Alexander's empire being divided into four parts and so forth. We also talked about Seleucus and everything. But I want you to notice the he-goat here that we talked about signified that one should come and reign from the Greeks, and that by the great horn which sprang out of the forehead of the he-goat was meant the first king. We saw that. That the springing up of four horns upon its falling off signified successors would rise after the death of the first king. And that from among them there should arise a king that should overcome our nation and their nation and their laws, and should take away political government, spoil the temple, and forbid sacrifices to be offered. And indeed, it came to pass under Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, the reason why I went over that is because I want you to understand that this is not something that took place in a moment of time. You get that? To us, it's a moment of time, because we're sitting here reading it. But what's recorded here took place over a period of time. And this is something that was prophesied and fulfilled exactly the way it was supposed to be. That's what God said was going to happen. Now, in Daniel's vision, he heard a holy one, which is an angel, asking another holy one, an angel, "How long shall be the vision concerning the daily and the..." The what? "Transgression of desolation." Now, this term pops up in Matthew 24. And in Matthew 24, Jesus says, "When you see the abomination of desolation, you don't go into your house. You don't go anywhere. You get out of the city immediately." Now, he wasn't talking about what Daniel was talking about here, because this was back then. But in the book of Revelation, we can see what took place was something that Jesus prophesied again in Matthew 24. And certainly they did overrun Jerusalem, and not a single Christian was killed. That's interesting. How did they know? How did they know to get out of there? Suppose they paid attention to Jesus? I think so. I think so. But of course, there were plenty of Jews that paid the price of staying there. Okay. He said, "And then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." 2,300 days. Julie? What?
No, two different times.
That's two different times,
and
Julie.
In Israel,
there were. Right. Now, this is in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. That's not now. No, no, Antiochus Epiphanes didn't. There weren't any Christians to kill. That was 175 years before Jesus was born.
Well, you said God's people. You said he had human sacrifices.
Yes. Yes, he did. 175 BC.
God's people at that time were the Jews.
God's people were the Jews. There weren't any Christians then.
And then when he was talking about in Matthew just a minute ago.
Yes.
Then he was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem.
That's right.
When Jesus was telling them
yep.
what was
going to
happen.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That's right. Very good. Very good. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. In Daniel's vision, then, the transgression of desolation had to do with what took place under Antiochus Epiphanes. That's all the pollution of the temple and the ending of sacrifices, the ending of all these things that took place under him, okay? Now, he said, that is the angel, that 2,300 days and then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. This, again, is prophetic language. We talked about what this 2,300 days meant and how it figured in to the prophetic picture in our previous lesson. Now, it appears to be, as before we said, an approximate time and not a precise, exact, literal number. The 2,300 days, now remember now, listen, this is what I say, was more than 6 years and less than seven. And the approximate period of time of the abominations of Antiochus Epiphanes. Approximate. But whenever he was done for, it was time to cleanse the temple. And the prophecy said so. Go ahead, Mickey.
Just to clarify a little bit, why so many died? Because they had not been faithful. The Jews, the Israelites, had not been faithful. And God had told them, but they did not heed it. So now they're going through this time period where these horrible things are happening and a lot died. But in the New Testament, when Jesus tells about the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew, the Christians listened and they heeded the word and left, and that's why they didn't die. So just to kind of, I just wanted to get that in
that's
mind
good.
Straight.
Yeah. Okay. The oppression of the people by the little horn that we're talking about here was to continue not for a full period of 7 years. That's what we just saw. Thus, the answer of the angels was literally this. The time of the predicted oppression of Israel and of the desolation of the sanctuary by Antiochus, the little horn, shall not reach the full duration of a period of divine judgment, which is 7 years. That's right. Interesting. Yes.
I just want to read what mine says. It's an NIV, so you know.
We're in trouble.
I'm
Okay?
Okay, it says the 2,300 evenings and mornings probably refer to the number of sacrifices consecutively offered on 1,150 days, the interval between the desecration of the Lord's altar and its reconsecration by Judas Maccabeus.
Well, first of all, the number of sacrifices doesn't mean anything because the Jews weren't offering any sacrifices.
Okay. But the numbers add to the right numbers.
Yeah, yeah, it would come out right to the right numbers. I know where the NIV is going with that, though.
Oh, okay.
It's going to premillennialism.
Okay.
I think you'd be better to leave that at home. Put notes in a new one. Okay. All right, Julie. Okay. We're almost out of time. I think we better wrap it up here and just pick up with where we are here next week. Oh, no, next week's thing, right? Am I right? Third? Yeah, I am right. Yeah, third Wednesday. Okay. We'll pick up with this then in 2 weeks and go on in our studies. I hope that, pardon the squeaky wheels, but I hope that these lessons are being beneficial to you and that you're finding information that you didn't have before and that it will help you to...